Welcome to the Dietitian Rehab Podcast, where we not only challenge and inspire dietitians to think outside the traditional dogmatic education, training, and attitudes for a mind wide open, but also to challenge anyone to think differently about their own health. We'll talk all things food, health, and nutrition related as we explore points of view, evidence, and strategies for better health that will allow you a fuller understanding of the hot topics that everybody's talking and asking about. Hey everyone, welcome to today's show. I'm your host, Doug Cook, and today we're going to be talking with Brian Sanders. Brian graduated from UCLA with a degree in mechanical engineering and then turned to technology where he started and sold an app company. He then used his technological background and love for fitness and nutrition to also work as a health coach and be the co-founder of the health, media, and technology company, Sapien. He's also the filmmaker behind the feature-length documentary Food Lies and is the host of the Peak Human podcast. The documentary Food Lies examines the scandals and misinformation in health and nutrition that has led to what he calls harmful dietary guidelines, such as the former food pyramid, My Plate, and various food guides that are used around the world, which he says caused and led to poor health. So his show examines the history of the dietary guidelines and tries to answer the question, what should humans really be eating? And without further hesitation, let's get to the show. Well, welcome to the show, Brian. I'm really happy to have you on, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with you about your amazing work and your amazing film.
Well, yeah, thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
So before we jump into the work you're doing, the film, and all the knowledge you obviously have from working with all these amazing experts, I'm just wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you became interested in the world of health in general, but more specifically ancestral nutrition principles and the problems with our modern food supply and the dietary guidelines, which all led to the film Food Lies, which is quite provocative.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I never was really concerned about my health or what I ate for a while. And I think that is mirrored in a lot of people around the world, right? You just kind of go about your life until something bad happens. And for me, it wasn't exactly something to my own body that went bad. It's my family's health and my parents. I mean, I basically lost both my parents when I was about 30. That was about 7 years ago. I just turned 37, and it's also the time, you know, you turn 30 and you can't eat whatever you want. But I didn't have any overt problems. And I think it's important because some people have these crazy tales and, you know, this, they get into the health world because of overcoming something. But All I overcame was mediocrity, I guess. I overcame being 30 and being kind of skinny fat and just kind of not living optimally, but thinking that I was. So that's the kind of key is, I was the in shape guy, like in my group, you know, because other 30-year-olds had dad bods and they were just gained a lot of weight and just having more problems and, you know, some people on different medications and all that. So just me by not being really overweight, I was like the in shape guy. Then I made some changes in my life. I got into ancestral nutrition. I got into Mark Sisson, you know, everyone knows Mark Sisson and in the ancestral health world. He's been doing this forever. He's just, it's a great concept and take on this, and he's a great communicator. And I started getting into that, started changing my diet, made a few simple changes, and I lost 4 pant sizes. You know, so I went from the in shape guy to like the actually in shape guy. And I realized how much I was missing by just changing my diet a little bit. I was like, whoa, this is what health is, right? This is what health is. My parents didn't have to go through this. They thought they were healthy. They thought they were eating a good diet. We were all making our own food, doing what the guidelines told us. We weren't out eating at fast food restaurants. We weren't doing any of the things that a lot of people who are in worse shape were doing, but they progressively got sicker and succumb to these chronic diseases that we think are normal now. And I guess I was on that path where I was just slowly like, oh yeah, you just gain a pound a year. That's a classic thing. You gain a pound a year and from your 20s until you're 50. And then you're like, oh, I'm 30 pounds overweight. And so is everyone else. So that's kind of my story and why I got into health. And I think it's important for people who think they're okay that probably aren't okay. I was getting sick, you know, every few months, like everyone else, or, you know, whatever, how many times a year. I had chronic inflammation in my wrists. I couldn't work at a computer anymore. And that was off and on for 10 years. And that went away when I started eating well. My kind of allergies went away. Like so many little things went away. And you're just a new person. So that's my health side. And my quick backstory is I went to mechanical engineering school. So I don't have a health background, but I guess you could say I was unencumbered by that because a lot of people in the health profession that I know of in the mainstream are kind of bought into the old way of doing things, the standard narrative, the standard way of doing things, this old textbooks that, you know, hey, eat the low fat diet and cholesterol's bad and salt's bad and all this stuff. And I didn't really have that going in. So I had a chance to use sort of engineering principles, scientific method, hopefully what all doctors should be doing in science, people and researchers that won't be kind of misled by outside interests and all this other stuff that's going on that we can get into later about the film. But I have this science background, mechanical engineering, and a tech background and a film background. I grew up just with film. And I kind of put those all together to make this film, Food Lies. So that's what I've been doing for the past 3 years, full-time doing podcasts. I've talked to over 150 amazing experts around the world, just world famous nutrition and anthropologists, regenerative agriculture people, so many different great people. And I think my role is to be the communicator, put these things together and get them out into a nice package for people to understand and not hopefully be biased and look at all sides. So that's my story.
That's an amazing story. So there's a couple of things that jump out at me because to your point, everybody thinks they're healthy. They don't realize how healthy they could be if they tried something different until they do. And then for me, what's amazing is, so I don't know, I was interested in nutrition from a young age and health. I went back to school to study nutrition because I was just interested in it. I had no intention of being a dietitian. Now I am. So having been in the field for 22 years, you point out an interesting phenomenon. And so like you said, there's scientists in the nutrition field, biochemists, whatever, lipidologists, doctors who should be applying the scientific method. But having lived this experience, there's huge influences from food industry and pharmaceutical industries. So that's obviously going to bias people's viewpoints. And then there's entire hundreds of millions of dollars have gone into research around something like a very specific example, the glycemic index. So entire careers. And so there's these pressures to kind of produce these results that favor these things. But anyway, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, Ivor Cummins, or I've heard of him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's a biochemical engineer. Then we have people like you who are looking at this stuff from a problem, like through a problem lens. I'm not an engineer. Root cause, using a problem analysis or solutions analysis, which is really unbiased. It's like, if this is happening with glucose, you know, forget what other people are saying that might come from the grain industry. Like, it's you guys who's that lens that is actually deconstructing and kind of correcting this, because it's not politically based, it's not industry based. So I just think it's amazing how we're taking this mechanistic view from people like you, engineers, is what's actually solving the problem. It's not mm-hmm. the health field.
Well, yeah, it's both. And there's guys like Dave Feldman too, who's another engineer who's doing this stuff and looking at cholesterol. And then Dr. Ted Naiman started as a mechanical engineer and then got a medical degree. So yeah, there's a lot of other people doing this. It's just interesting that there are a bunch of engineers.
Yeah, it really is a problem that should be approached from a really kind of objective problem-solving lens. And so I think that's amazing. So the cat's out of the bag. It's not going anywhere. So things are changing, which is amazing. So in your own words, can you just tell us what the movie's about and what you want people to get out of it?
Yeah. Well, I kind of am rewriting it from scratch in the last few months. During lockdown, we had a chance to just rethink it, make it way better. We're waiting to film some things still. But it's kind of a three-parter where we're looking at what should humans eat, right? This is the biggest question that the movie's trying to answer, right? So we need to look at all sides of what is going to lead us there. And a lot of people just look at one way of thinking, or they just, you know, look at, oh, well, this is the modern food environment, or this is what the studies show, so we're going this direction. Instead, we're going to use the entire human evolution. We're looking at anthropology. We're looking at the fossil record. We're looking at, there's so many great studies and other information out there about how humans evolved, and that, including prehumans, was millions of years, right? If you keep including Homo habilis, and even looking at, you know, how Neanderthals ate and what happened to them, and just go throughout the entire human past, we see that we were actually very carnivorous for millions of years. And then we got more diversity of foods and things changed. And yes, humans can adapt to things. And then people know there's the agricultural revolution, and about 10,000 years ago, we kind of settled down and changed our diets more. And well, actually at that time is when we actually got shorter and our brains got smaller and we got more disease and all this stuff. And we started eating these modern, well, they weren't even modern, but just agricultural foods. So there's a good argument that suggests that we don't thrive as much on the grains and all these agricultural foods. So there's a lot of evidence that shows we do better on animal-based diets. You could look at the bioavailability of nutrients from animal foods compared to plant foods, and you could come to the same conclusion. So I won't go to all the details now, but that's kind of the first segment of the film, right? It's like what does history show us? And we even look at more modern history. There's the ethnographic atlas where researchers studied 100 something tribes around the world and saw how they ate. Again, none of them were vegan, and most of them relied over 50% on plant foods. I mean, animal food, sorry. And we look at Weston Price, went around the world studying all these native cultures that didn't start eating the modern foods. And when they did start eating the modern foods, their health declined rapidly. Then we look at the agricultural revolution. Then we go into the modern area. And it was a kind of the what went wrong section of the film, right? So this whole film, it's basically so many people out in this nutrition world have done tons of study on their own and listen to a million podcasts and lectures and books. They have so much knowledge in their head. They wish they could just download it to someone because their friends, their family, you know, all these other people are like, hey, but you know, cholesterol is bad for you. So, you know, this and that. If you could just download this in someone's head, they maybe would see what we're talking about here. So my idea is to let's get the perfect 95 minutes, whatever, 105 minutes. We're pushing it a little bit. A video, audio-visual presentation of the best we can possibly do to get all this fact-based information out there. And we have hundreds of studies. We have a whole companion site that will show little numbers on the screen, and you can look up the study that we're referring to in this companion website and know that this is all science-based, and it's not like a, you know, the Game Changers film that's, you know, these vegan propaganda films that stray away from science because they have an agenda. So, okay, so I'm back to the middle of the film. We're doing a what went wrong section. And there, you know, some people know about the Ansel Keys story, and it's been, you know, told a million times, but just about how he thought saturated fat was the cause of heart disease. And there's another guy, John Yudkin, who thought it was sugar and refined grains, and Ansel Keys won. And, you know, all the repercussions of that through the food guidelines and recommendations in the 80s. And then that's when the spike in obesity and chronic disease, when we really said, eat a low fat diet, eat, and all of the processed foods and the food industry took over. And if you can't have fat in the food, you have to add sugar. There's just so much of the story that led us to where we are today. And then we need to also look at the environmental side. So we have a whole regenerative agriculture section and talk about that. And we can get into any of these details now on the podcast, and, you know, why the vegan anti-meat activists and people like that are just, they don't have the full story. They have an agenda, and, you know, animals are not inherently bad for the environment. It doesn't make any sense. It's opposite. It's just the management of animals is what matters. And if you manage animals correctly, they benefit the environment. And then kind of the ending of the film, we do make some recommendations. We do piece it together because I don't want just a film that's just like you know, eat whatever, like anything's good. Other nutrition films I've seen, they're just like, oh yeah, well just eat less, move more. You know, that's the whole thing. It's like, mm-hmm. just eat a bunch of plants and just eat less and move more. So we don't do that. We have some more, I think, science-based and anecdotal-based and many things-based conclusions that we come to.
And so did you set out to make it an anti-vegan film, or is just the preponderance of evidence shows that the ideal diet is not going to be vegan, which I believe, but I just...
I didn't want to make an anti-vegan film. So we actually don't... I may have made it seem like that when I was just talking about it, but we are getting a vegan doctor in it, and we talk about plant-based as like... You know, as long as it's not 100% plant-based, that it might be pretty okay. But this, yeah, the evidence shows more towards an animal-based diet, you know, working better.
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting at. It wasn't like this is an anti-vegan, because some people will see, I think, some of the trailers, or as soon as they see cows or whatever, or they'll question the validity of vegan diets or processed foods that might be like soy wieners and stuff. They'll assume it's a quote-unquote anti-vegan, where it's just, this is the preponderance of the evidence shows that human beings thrive with some kind of animal foods in their diet. And I don't know if you said it on another podcast that I saw with you, but I don't think there's any archaeological evidence ever in the history of humanity that there was a vegan society, because no society would ever give up valuable food sources. And even Buddhists who are anti-violent will eat eggs and dairy in Nepal or whatever. So like that, even that changes the whole formula when it comes to health.
Yeah. Part of that was the ethnographic atlas that I briefly mentioned, is they studied, I don't know why, I think it's 212 or is it 189 different native living populations. And yeah, none of them were vegan. There was one or two that were pretty plant-based by just force. They didn't have access to that many animal foods. And then something like 76% of these native living populations got over 50% of their food from animal foods. So yeah, it is. The preponderance of evidence, you could look at it a thousand ways, and it all points to the animal foods. But yeah, I like that we don't want to be anti-vegan. I just don't like anti-meat activists spreading misinformation. So we just want to clear things up. But I have this idea of a sapien diet or sapien way of eating, because it's not a diet. I mean, it's a way of life. It's a way of eating. And that there's many ways to eat. And as long as it's based on whole foods and eating like locally and seasonally, and you don't have to be Sean Baker and eat a steak every day. You can do all kinds of different things. We like you said, even these Buddhist monks, they know the importance of the animal foods and the eggs and, you know, the dairy products. And even a quick example in India, a lot of people think India is just pure vegetarian, but I have a researcher, writer, helper who was saying they looked it up, and it's something like only like 10% of Indians are actually very plant-based, and that it's just this idea that they all are, but they're not.
Yeah, and any culture throughout history, as you say, this ethnogeography, they would eat whatever's available. So if you live near the water, you're going to be eating a lot more fish. You're not going to be eating bison, right? So it's like, to your point, it's not about eating steak, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but it's going to be eating what's local and fresh and whatever you can get your hands on, I guess, which is an animal, because they're going to run away. So I've lived this experience being a dietitian. So I went back to school, and it really is a form of indoctrination and professional socialization. I graduated, I go into the hospitals, I have preceptors, I'm learning my clinical nutrition. I'm a newbie, I'm not questioning anything. And it really is like the food guide. And that's what we had before the plate. You guys had the food pyramid, and you know the story. It's grain-based plants with small amounts of animal foods. And then you look at the food supplies, all these processed foods, et cetera. And we talked about Ansel Keys and these other big players that influence policy. But I'm just wondering if you can just broad stroke, or as detailed as you feel, kind of going through the history of where we got it wrong and ended up spreading all this bad information. Because I'm old enough to remember a lot of this stuff from way back when.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I lived through it. I was born in 83. So yeah, I was grew up, it's sad that I grew up probably with pretty bad nutrition, eating all the low-fat products that my, you know, parents were buying and just basing everything on bread and pasta and rice. But I think it really started with the demonization of meat. And that's like the bigger story. Other people have gotten into this more than me. There's Dr. Gary Fetke and his wife, Belinda Fetke, who are Australians. Mm-hmm. He's an orthopedic surgeon. So he's the guy that comes in and chops off people's arms and legs when they have type 2 diabetes for too long. And he's really passionate about this. He actually got put on trial for making recommendations to not eat processed foods and sugar, like a very obvious thing, because of dietitians and these religious zealots over there in Australia. They're really kind of taken over in the sanitarium. They have all these processed foods that they're selling, and that they just control the dietitians, and a lot of the medical literature is put out by these people. So they've looked into a lot. They'll be in the film. They kind of trace it back to the Seventh-day Adventists. And this was in America in the late 1800s, you know, 1880s. It's a woman, Ellen G. White, and she had these visions. Well, I mean, she has her own past, a troubling past. And it was also a time when we were trying to gain women's rights. We were also moving out of the countryside to the city, and we didn't have as much access to fresh, good meat. This was also the time when we were having problems with alcohol, or men maybe had more problems with alcohol and were maybe beating their wives. There's different stories of what was going on at this time. Mm-hmm. And she thought that meat made men angry, that there was this like carnal rage if men ate meat, and that it would be better if no one drank alcohol or ate red meat. So this was just the perception. It wasn't scientific, but this is kind of where it started. And you could trace it a little bit back, where some religious people throughout the ages just had this idea that it was not as holy or godly to eat this meat, right? So it wasn't based on anything scientific. It's just maybe because it has so many nutrients and you have virility and you thrive on it, that maybe they associated that with something bad and they wanted to be holy. And just, well, that's actually part of the story, is John Harvey Kellogg believed that he was this whole anti-masturbation story, actually, that if you ate this bland diet, you wouldn't have sexual desires. And that it was, again, he was tied up in the Seventh-day Adventist thing. And it was just this whole era from the 1880s to the 1920s and 30s when this was taking place. And it's just really interesting how this all went down. And they had these retreats, this sanitarium. It was also called the Sanitarium, which is also the new food company in Australia, where people would go to eat these plant-based diets and to try to cleanse themselves. So it really was born out of a religious idea. And they thought it was the Garden of Eden diet, that it was supposed to be pure. They thought that the Bible said that, you know, talking about the Garden of Eden, that it was just fruits and vegetables and everything was great until meat came along. And the snake maybe even represented like animal foods or something. But that message, meat was blamed for different things almost every decade. And not all of it was science-based. And so in the 50s, we're talking about Ansel Keys. That time, it was the cholesterol and the saturated fat that was bad in the red meat. Then it moved in the 60s and 70s, it was the environmental stuff, right? They're like, oh, well, this is bad for the environment, and the hippie movement. And then there was the time when, oh, and then blaming it heart disease, sorry, in the 50s, you know, the saturated fat, the cholesterol, and the heart disease. Then they go into the 80s and 90s, and it's like, oh, it's cancer. Meat causes cancer. And the World Health Organization had a working group that decided that meat was a carcinogen. People probably know about this, 2015. So I interviewed a USDA scientist who was on that panel, who just a, you know, just regular guy. He believes in just, doesn't have any dietary beliefs. He's kind of just like one of those, like, eat less, move more, just eat balanced diet. But he supports meat eating. He's just like, yeah, this is, I look at the science. This is obvious. We eat meat and there's no science showing that we shouldn't. And he presented data to this group, this working panel in 2015, and they ignored him. They didn't even accept the studies that he submitted. And he said that many of them were vegan and vegetarians. And he said that they were purposely not looking at this data, and they used a lot of, you know, animal rodent data to try to say it. And he picked apart those studies and showed why they didn't work. So if you actually look at it, there is no good science that meat causes cancer. And if there are some correlations, it's because people aren't eating meat in a healthy way. And that, and I think this is why they showed that there's more problems with people eating processed meat. I actually don't even think if you're eating decent processed meat without much else, I don't think it's that bad at all. It's just when you're eating more processed meat, you're eating it with more, even more processed foods. And this is the problem, is the combination of you're eating a hot dog with a bun and a soda, and then the hamburger with the bun and the soda and the fries and the milkshake. And this is what's really going on. And it's called a healthy user bias, where people who don't choose to eat fast food and eat more plant-based diets, they have way more healthy activities. So a lot of this stuff in nutrition science is just correlational, and it's epidemiology. And I mean, the definition of epidemiology and these correlational studies are to show that they cannot show causation. The whole idea is that they show correlation and that you do more studies to prove it. And we don't, it's hard to do a lot of these studies, and we don't have any good hard science that shows meat is bad. Why would it be bad? What really is bad is the new modern processed foods. It's very obvious to people who, you know, look into nutrition a little bit below the surface and realize we have two competing ideas. We have that red meat is bad, or animal food's bad, or that processed foods are bad. One's been around for all of history and made us human, meat eating and fish and all this stuff. And then one has just come around in the, you know, really in the last 50 years in a really bad way. But one is this modern concoction of processed foods and industrial seed oils and refined grains and pesticides and a million other things going on. And it seems really obvious that that's the problem. And so people just associate the meat with what's bad when it's everything else. I have a shirt that says it's what else you eat, not the meat.
Yeah, I've seen that shirt. So I think I need to get one, because it is true. It's really, really good. Yeah, it's fascinating because a lot of people don't realize this. I didn't realize this, as I always joke as a baby dietitian, that you assume what you're being taught and has been vetted and it's based on facts and science, and you don't realize the politics behind it, or these influences, like you were saying, these religious influences that could have influenced policymakers, that it's not based on evidence and you assume it is. And then these, you know, sweeping policies come through, it affects the food supply, et cetera. And, you know, there's been so many, again, to your point, so many alterations in not just how we eat, but what we eat. Like, we never ate large amounts of omega-6 oils. It just wasn't present in the food supply. So now we have all these vegetable oils that are flooding the market. And we're living this large, ongoing prospective population-based study to see what the ill effects are. And there's good evidence that there is a lot of ill effects, but we just kind of make these leaps of faith that, but I remember as a student, like there was somebody with a high cholesterol and the preceptor was like, well, you have to add 2 to 3 tablespoons of vegetable oil to lower the LDL.
Oh, no.
Like just pure vegetable oil on top of everything else you're eating, because we got to push down the LDL. But the other thing that people don't get is that, you know, there's these steering committees for all of these different organizations, and they decide what evidence to include, like you said, with the guy who tried to submit some studies around meat not being harmful. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example in Canada was the steering committee members for the diabetes guidelines. They were both vegan and very, very pro-carbohydrate. So It's the diabetes guidelines. We know carbohydrate causes problems for people with diabetes. They still pushed a high carbohydrate diet, but their solution was try to reduce the impact of the carbohydrate on blood sugar by lowering the glycemic index, eating fiber, etc. But for us, it took so long before they allowed the percentage of calories from protein to go from 15 to 20%, because I would still try to keep the protein in check and still lean towards a higher carbohydrate diet. And so people don't understand this history of, like people like the Fetkes have pointed out, where these influencers are in place. And I remember, I think you mentioned on another talk, a book called Recipes for a Small Planet. from the 70s.
Diet for a Small Planet, yeah.
Yeah, Diet for a Small Planet. So I had that book because I was quasi-vegetarian for a couple of years. And I had that book and I was like, it's just strange because we have all these weird foods and we kind of choke them down. And it's just, it is like we never would have survived as a species if we were eating a lot of the foods that we were today a million years ago, or trying to extract nutrients from soy grits and white rice and, you know, tempeh or I don't know if you know, textured vegetable protein. So they make this mash out of soy and they kind of shape it into nuggets and then you can make stir fries and stuff. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people think that if you can survive on it today, it must be okay, not realizing that that's easy to say now that we've evolved to where we are today. But what is it going to look like 100 or 200 or 300 years from now?
Well, that's the big thing is survive or thrive. And I think there's a lot of confusing things going on in nutrition. And yeah, I'm like deep in the film and we're wrestling with all these concepts and how to present them. But one big one is survive or thrive is that humans, it's sad that we have this kind of fallback mode. This is what I call it like the failed environment metabolic state. When your environment fails you, like whether it's an ice age, you know, for long periods of history, or how northern you were in the world and the climate, or if there was natural disasters, or simply just failed to hunt, your environment failed you in some way. We have a secondary kind of metabolism, which runs almost like these high carb vegans, right? It's like you can do a low protein, high carb, high plant-based diet and technically live. And this is a great evolutionary mechanism. It's our fallback diet. It's our fallback metabolism. And we can do okay. And we don't seem to get heart disease and we don't seem to, you know, get overweight and all the other diseases. But that doesn't mean it's good. It means that we adapted this way to survive. And what I believe is the optimal nutrition, the primary diet, is those animal foods and high fat. And we had, you know, giant woolly mammoth, and we had just giant animals that we could pretty easily get, and bison. People know there was millions and tens of millions, 100 million bison roaming the North American plains. I mean, it was not hard to get meat and fat, especially when there was way less humans around back in the day. Humans are smart. We had the same brains, you know, for a long time. And just because we didn't have an iPhone doesn't mean we didn't have ingenuity and skills, and we were actually better at manipulating our environment back then because that's all we had, and we could catch food and this was not a problem. We could get seafood. We were always around the shore. We were eating shellfish. At the very least, we could pick oysters and clams and mussels. And I interviewed a great woman, Dr. Lee Broadhurst, who worked with Dr. Stephen Kinane and Michael Crawford to develop all these theories and evidence showing how humans always survived and thrived around water and lakes and shores and, you know, these DHAs. This is what likely built our brains. And, you know, we kind of know why did our brains grow so big during this time? And I love their theory, I guess you could call it, because nothing's ever accepted, you know, or, you know, you can't say that it's 100%, but that humans were eating all this seafood with high DHA content, and the brain is basically made up of, you know, DHA and these good omega-3s and cholesterol. So this is our optimum diet. This is what Weston Price found. This is what so many people found, that this is the optimum way of living with the animal foods, but we have this backup system of the fallback foods. So that's the survive or thrive thing. And then also in modern culture, we have this idea of if it produces weight loss, then it's good. We don't have an idea of like what's an actual good diet that has complete nutrition that is delicious, actually enjoyable and sustainable for life. It's doable for a long period. That's confused with something that produces weight loss. And weight loss doesn't always even mean fat loss. If you're doing a vegan diet, you're actually losing a lot of muscle a lot of times, because most of the time you're not getting full bioavailable protein. So I talked to some great muscle scientists, protein scientists. One guy up in Canada, Dr. Stu Phillips, also talked to Dr. Keith Barr about this. And of course, they say you need animal protein. You need this full bioavailable protein and you need a certain amount of it to maintain your muscle mass. And a lot of times there's great studies showing that people who lose weight without enough good protein, complete animal protein, they put him on a DEXA scan where you can actually see the amount of muscle and fat. And so they both lost some weight on the scale, both groups, but the group that ate the animal protein actually lost almost all fat and gained a little muscle. And the group that was not getting that animal protein lost muscle and a little bit of fat. So that's just a great example of what goes on in society, especially with these quick fixes and you do the juice cleanse. I think juice cleanse is one of the worst things you could do. It's basically just pure sugar and it's no protein. So at the end of it, you're addicted to sugar even more than you may already have been. And just your body wants it and craves it. And you've probably lost a lot of muscle mass along with some of that fat that you thought you were losing. So yeah, that we have many problems with diets, and part of it is confusing weight loss with just that's what makes a good diet, and part of it is just you can survive on many diets, but we want to know what you thrive on.
Yeah, I think it's something that people can't wrap their head around. They haven't kind of been able to put it in those terms because it's this idea that if you can get by on these things, it's doable, and that's all that matters. But there's this big disconnect because I have someone in my circle who is a vegan, and you know, we just had friendly talks, and you know, I'm kind of talking about, you know, it's anthropologically it doesn't make sense. It's never been a vegan society in history. And it allowed us to be who we are. And it's just the idea that, well, we no longer have to do it because we're kind of at this end stage of evolution, or that, to your point, that you can get by on it and survive. And then it goes off topic because it gets, you know, quite religious in tone and, you know, philosophy and hurting animals. And like, you can get lost in a lot of that kind of stuff. I just don't know what the answer is or what the future holds, because you know what the food supply is like. They say there's 30,000 food items in a grocery store. And then in my circles, you know, we're so afraid of calling foods good or bad or healthy or unhealthy because you don't want it to create disordered eating or legitimate kind of self-loathing potential ideas around your food choices. And then there's people who struggle just to eat. But I don't know how to get out of it, because the fact is there are foods that don't move us towards health. And then I don't want to bury my head in the sand and pretend that's not true and just say, oh, all foods can fit and just, you know, balance variety. And that's kind of the movement that a lot of people in my field are dealing with, like health at every size and food freedom. To get away from those kind of hangups. I don't know if people you interviewed have ideas or if you have ideas. Like, I just don't know how we kind of get beyond that to the promised land.
That's a hard one. Now, I have interviewed some food psychologists type of people. I interviewed the woman who wrote the textbook on food addiction. I interviewed another guy that is a psychologist and talks about this stuff. But I've always been fascinated in this too, because there is a fine line between saying all foods are fine, you just have to eat them in moderation. And, you know, that is a slippery slope. But then there is some truth to it where I don't think I'm going to be poisoned if I eat one slice of cheesecake once in a year or something. You know what I mean? It's like, I get it. There are no evil foods. It's not like this is pure evil. And I don't want to create some weird energy around it. And for me, it does work because I eat my healthy, nutrient-dense diet all week, all month. And then, yeah, I mean, if I'm in a certain occasion and we're having a cheesecake, I'm going to have a slice of that cheesecake. And I know that it's not going to kill me because I know that my body's resilient and humans are amazing and we can handle things, especially in acute situations, but we can't handle them in chronic situations. And if I just had a little, you know, oh, I'm just going to have a little slice of cheesecake every other day, that's a recipe for disaster. So there is a lot of context, and I see how you have to get into these nuances, and you don't want to create weird energies, you know, negative energy around food, but you also have to make some solid recommendations. And part of it, I think, is working with what type of person it is. I think there's the type of person that can eat something like one treat once a week and be fine. And I know other people that they'll eat, even if it's just, I don't know, a potato, they'll maybe it's their gut bacteria. You know, their gut microbiome will go crazy and they get all these starches again, and then they're going to be binging on, you know, cupcakes and candy that whole week if they do it. So you have to kind of know what kind of eater you are. And yeah, I guess it's just, it is a nuanced conversation and there is no direct answer.
Yeah, it is nuanced. I do think there's, well, I'm speaking for myself. Yeah, there's foods that are good, foods that aren't good. Foods move you towards health, they don't. If you press anybody to quantify or qualify balance, variety, and moderation, they can't, of course, because there's no answer. But, and that's why people talk about the 80-20 rule or the 90-10 rule, where you do, quote, the good stuff 90% of the time and then have those indulgences. So, yeah, I think people often have this intuitive sense that what we're eating in the modern diet is at odds with our genetics and our DNA and that type of thing. And the proof is in the pudding when we talk about chronic disease. So with the film, was there any surprises to you that came out when you talk about these food lines?
Well, so what happened with me is I was always trying to go in this unbiased and, you know, have an open mind. And looking back, I think I kind of 3 years ago when I first started, it's, you know, it's a long, slow process. I was kind of just going down this route of, I figured out the ancestral eating and I was like, okay, high fat is great and, you know, carbs are bad. I think I did get a little bit caught up in that thing where this is the only way to do it. But I ran across a great woman, Denise Minger, wrote a book called Death by Food Pyramid. You know, I interviewed her for the film and she had some great ideas about there's ways to do things on both sides. It's kind of what I was talking about. There is this second way of eating as long as you don't get caught in the middle, right? This is where most of the world is they're caught up in a high carb and high fat diet, or they're just eating in moderation. They're eating all the foods. The people who tend to do well, and if you study different societies, native living societies, they're usually either on one side of the spectrum where you have, they have a lot of fat and meat and they don't have a lot of starches and, well, they certainly don't have all the processed foods and they do great. And then you have the people on the far other end, there's like Ketavans or C1A or, you know, some of these more modern people, you could think of like the Okinawans with their sweet potatoes and some fish and some vegetables. So they're not eating sugars and highly refined foods. And maybe they are going higher carb and higher plant-based, but they're still doing okay. They're eating whole foods and they're not getting caught in the middle and just eating basically a bunch of trash that happens when you kind of just eat in the middle, you know, high carb, high fat. So basically, and I also learned more about why that works. You know, you hear about the potato diet and there's, I think it was like Penn Jillette lost like 100 pounds doing the potato diet. All you use potatoes and there's all these reasons why it can work. You end up not eating too much because you can only eat plain potatoes with no salt, no butter, no anything. But if you go high carb enough, and you go low fat enough, your body actually can't put on fat. Yeah, I mean, you will lose weight because there's no fat for you to gain. You're just constantly running through that glucose and you're not storing any fat because you're not even eating any fat. So I just learned more about how the body works and that there are some unifying themes that all the good diets do and all good diets don't do. So I think this was a huge benefit for my career, you could call it. I mean, I do work with a doctor and we have a health program and we do all kinds of stuff, but it helped me for the film as well so that I didn't go down this route of just making a keto film or something, or like, this is a low carb film, or this is just a meat based thing film. It's more like, hey, I kind of get it at a higher level now that many different diets can work, but what are the good things and what are the bad things? And it goes back to Weston Price too. It's like, we're confirming all the stuff that he found. He found that none of the societies were eating sugar, refined grains or vegetable oils, these seed oils. And when they did, they went bad. And what they were all doing, all these very disconnected societies all over the world, they all had these traditions around pregnancy, especially around having a child. And while the child is growing, and for the mother and even the father, they're eating these nutrient-dense animal foods. They're eating the organs and the fat and the eggs and fish eggs and seafood and all these things that we now know have all the fat-soluble vitamins and all these great things to help grow a child. So that's kind of where I landed, is that there are these unifying themes and theories, and there is no one way of eating, But there kind of is one way of eating, which is the framework, the sapient framework, I'm calling it, is just not having the processed foods and embracing the nutrient-dense animal foods.
As much as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a new thing for me because I always thought the balance was okay, right? So when we talk about balance, 45 to 55% of the calories come from carbs, somewhere like, you know, 15, 20 protein, and the rest is fat. And I guess this goes into this new thing that I've just learned about, believe it or not, after 22 years. I've heard it kicked around. People will say that on social media, like, oh, it's when fats and carbs are combined, that's the devil. This whole thing about the Randall effect. So if you have
Randall cycle,
fat,
yeah.
Cycle, yeah, fat and carb at the same time, it interferes with how each of those are metabolized. So to your point, when people can do really well when it's high carb, low fat, or the opposite, because of those substrates, those macronutrients are, I guess, somehow used more efficiently for fuel. So that's some of the contradictory explanations.
It's also just the hyperpalatability. It's sort of this push-pull thing. I was just thinking of that the combination of fat and carbs is delicious to humans. So, you know, it's part of it is just, you're just going to eat more, right? Mm-hmm. If you have this delicious combo, especially if you get to the ultimate hyperpalatability is the hyper processed foods, the donuts, the classic, the worst thing you can eat. It's made up of pure sugar, flour, vegetable oil. It's the perfect combination of carbs and fat and very, very low protein. And you can eat them forever. And then, of course, Doritos. I read a great book, Dorito Effect, and also interviewed the author about this, is these engineered flavors that kind of hijack the human brain and make them overread. And, you know, it's these fake flavors, and it's just the carbs and fat. You know, it's sort of this irresistible combo.
Yeah, people say, well, I crave carbs. It's like, well, fine, here's this plate of white rice or white plain pasta, mm-hmm. right? It's yeah. like, no, I want a donut. I want some ice cream. It's like, well, no, you want fat and sugar and that. To
you
hit
want
that
the pasta
sweet
sauce.
Spot.
Yeah, I want the bacon. You want yeah. the carbonara. I want the bacon and the sauce on the pasta.
Yeah, and people don't realize that hundreds of millions of dollars goes into making foods palatable for the very purpose of over-consuming. And if you gave a cave man or woman a Krispy Kreme, they'd go nuts, right? But back then, they didn't have that. They just had the mm-hmm. woolly mammoth and the low-starch tuber or something. So can I ask what you eat in a typical day? That's everyone's favorite yeah. question.
Sure. So I've kind of tried a million things, even just timing, right? When I'm eating, when I'm not eating, what I'm eating. And I've gotten down to this 2 meals a day. I'm eating at maybe 1:30 p.m. I'm not even hungry until 1:30 p.m., and I like to eat kind of like a classic breakfast type of meal without the carbs. I mean, I'll eat 3 eggs, bacon, sausage, avocado, maybe some like sauerkraut, maybe a little like, I have this like 2-ingredient salsa, like really simple. So basically all just simple foods, you know? I'm not doing anything special. I like to eat just that meat, eggs, fish, some cheese products, some low sugar fruits, which are like avocado or olives, or, you know, people don't think of them as fruits, and maybe, you know, cucumber would fit in there, and fermented vegetables, sauerkraut, you know, pickles, stuff like that. And then some of the, like the more organ meats. Well, I'm kind of doing a general, I went away from my first meal. So then I would eat the more nose to tail stuff, organs, bone broth, some other things like fish eggs, sardines, oysters, stuff like that. So yeah, for my first meal, it would be basically like a keto ratio type of meal. I want to kind of stay in ketosis. I'm not always in ketosis. I never track. I never think about it. But during the week, during lunch, I'll probably eat a keto ratio meal. Just like I said, some sort of protein, maybe some eggs, avocado, sauerkraut, stuff like that. And then I'm good. Actually go on the sun. I like to include that in my daily practice, is getting good vitamin D. I'm not going to get sunburned, but I'm going to go read out in the sun. Lucky to live in California, and I can do that almost daily. And then yeah, I'll work out at, you know, 7 p.m., 7:30. I do this short, intense workout, 17 minutes. You know, I'm doing, going to failure. I have 40-pound weight vest. I'm doing pull-ups and dips and squats and just, you know, throwing some dumbbells around. And then I eat a bigger meal, and I'm got a big steak. You eat a big ribeye, onions, mushrooms. You know, just simple stuff. Just have some sides. Like, you can just throw fermented vegetables in your fridge. You know, you have a jar of this, jar of that. And that's about it. I mean, I eat the 2 meals. They're in the second meal, maybe I'm eating more protein. Maybe I will have some carb sources or something. Again, I'm not worried about ketosis or anything, but I also want to refeed after my workout and have some, you know, good amount of food and protein. And I feel amazing, and I can easily maintain weight. This is kind of how I lost all the weight that I didn't even know I had, and lost the inches off my waist. And now, you know, I have a 28 inch waist. I have gained muscle. I don't think I have much visceral fat at all. And then the workout side is sprinting too. I like to do the sprinting. I like this high intensity stuff. I know you didn't ask about that, but I think it's really important that people just, you know, try out the more high intense stuff. I kind of did the whole cardio, you know, steady state, doing jogs and all that. And it didn't serve me well at all. I had terrible body composition for most of that time.
Yeah, no, it's amazing because it's a very familiar story. People do the pyramid, the food guide, they do the cardio, whether it's the treadmill, et cetera, 5K or whatever that is, 3 miles. And this is a classic, and this isn't just selective promo type stuff, but I know on one of your websites, you'll just point everybody to at the end, you have the picture of you wearing a white shirt, and you can see your face is a bit round, and you're kind of, that's the normal quote in shape that you were referring to. And then you've got one where you're shirtless, and this is a common story. People kind of adapt these basic principles, high intensity exercise, like our ancestors would have done. They weren't doing marathons, and just kind of eating more natural. We can argue to the cows come home about, you know, is it the low carb? Is it the lack of processed food? But it's just amazing. You see the same outcomes time and time and time and time again. The proof is in the pudding. And you know, as a practitioner, people adopt this stuff and I just have to stop really doing much more, you know, like their diabetes improves and all that kind of stuff. Just before we wrap up, I'm just curious, no pressure, any opinions on supplements at all?
I don't think they're too bad. I think if someone is really interested in eating nose to tail and they would eat organ meats and they'll eat oysters and they'll eat all these kinds of things, maybe they don't need them, but maybe many people don't do that. And it's easier for them to take a supplement. I mean, that's what it is, right? It's a supplement, a good diet, supposedly. And so, you know, there's these new like kind of organ pills, desiccated organ pills, I think are really cool. And there's a bunch of companies making them. So yeah, I think that's very bioavailable nutrition. I think it's good for people maybe who want to get fat adapted. You know, they want to, I think it's great to get fat adapted actually at some point in your life. You don't have to be keto forever. I'm not like a hardcore keto person, like I said, but if you get fat adapted, you know, for a few months, you're more metabolically flexible. You can handle fat burning and you can do carb burning, you know, and then you can kind of be more balanced as you go on with your life. But during that fat adaptation, a lot of people maybe need electrolytes and need to supplement some electrolytes. And maybe too, if you're just not eating as many fresh vegetables and stuff like that for one reason or another, then maybe you can also get those electrolytes, you know, through supplementation, get the potassium and magnesium, because, you know, maybe there's not as much in the animal foods. So yeah. And then I'm sure there's other ones too. Probiotics. I've heard some good things about some like spore-based probiotics. And just, I think a lot of people are just deficient in things like magnesium and DHA. And yeah, if you're vegan, I would, or more plant-based, I'd definitely look into like a really good DHA supplement.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. So where can people learn more about you, your movie, and all the amazing stuff you're doing?
Yeah, main thing is just sapien.org. It's kind of like the jump off page. You can find about the film there. It's foodlies.org. And, you know, I have Nose to Tail. That's actually my company. And, you know, we have different grass-fed meats and stuff like that. And it's where it all is. And Foodlies, if you just search any social media, I'm there, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Just search for Foodlies. And I try to put out at least one thing a day of just new things I'm thinking about, new research, all that type of stuff.
And where are you in the production, the post-production?
Well, yeah, we kind of started rewriting the whole thing.
Okay, gotcha.
So, no, we're doing well. I have sort of daily meetings for hours and hours, and we're going through it all. We have 90% filmed. We know what we're doing. We have 90% figured out, but we're just kind of rewriting it, and we need to film some more things. I think we're going to go to Africa, actually, and film with some tribes. So, waiting for the borders to open, and also the Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian in DC. We're talking to a great anthropologist there, and we want to film there. And so they're going to let us know when that opens.
Amazing. And you have a podcast.
Podcast Peak Human. Yes. I interview a lot of people from the film and far beyond. So about 98 episodes in. Great stuff.
Yeah, no, those are great names. I don't know who came up with those. Peak Human and Sapien is just, I mean, that says it all. I've taken up a lot of your time already. I really enjoyed it. I know listeners are going to really enjoy it. And I would encourage everybody to check out more on your social and your websites, rather, because you got some great resources there. And so, yeah, just to sum up, I want to thank you, Brian. Hope you have a good day. And I really enjoyed this.
Well, yeah, thanks for letting me share this info. That's kind of all I want to do.
Yeah, got the word out. Take care.
Hit subscribe and get ready to expand your nutritional world, your perspective, and gain confidence in a way that you didn't know you could. And be sure to check out my website, DougCookRD.com.